When we say history is doomed to repeat itself, it's not because of some ancient magical law of the universe. It's because the majority of humanity is too self-absorbed, too engrossed in their own present to examine the past. So we never learn from our mistakes. It's not history that repeats itself. It's us. Since about the 1970s, America and other parts of the Western world have seen a golden age for diaspora Jewry. Of course, as a minority, you're always going to get some bigotry here and there, but overall, Jews in this country were empowered to build an amazing life in this amazing place. For anyone born since that time, all they've ever known is a world in which Jews are safe, and as has been the case in most societies where Jews have been safe, we have built strong communities, contributed greatly to society, and thrived. And today, while all of this is still true, the once dormant and virulent virus of anti-Jew hate is again rearing its ugly head. Things were just so good before. How do we get back to normal? Well, in her book, People Love Dead Jews, which we talk about a lot on this show, author Dara Horn makes a chilling assertion, one so obvious and simple, yet one I'm certain most of you have not considered. In her view, and I think it's the right one, those halcyon days of Jewish safety weren't actually normal. They were the aberration. It is now a time darkened by widespread and normalized Jew hatred that is the real normal, the circumstances through which Jews have lived again and again for centuries. It was well before the rise of Hitler's Third Reich that the world began contemplating the Jewish problem. Contrary to contemporary Western belief, which knows only the recent past and not a minute earlier, Jews were long regarded as the lowest of the low, a pestilence to be removed. I mean, name one other minority in history whose very existence was openly and ubiquitously discussed as an international problem to be solved. It didn't matter how deeply the Jews were assimilated, how deferential they were to their majority masters, how wealthy or poor, how significantly they contributed to art, music, science, literature. They were the other, and really the only major other in otherwise homogeneous societies, and nobody liked them for it. Many forget or never learn that Hitler's final solution, that is the systematic extinction of Jews from the face of the earth, was never the original goal. From the outset, the plan had always been the forced emigration of Jews, not to kill them all, just to get rid of them all, to make Germany Judenrein, cleansed of Jews. And so steps were taken. The Nuremberg Laws were passed, dehumanizing and isolating Jews through legal means, making life so miserable they'd be fools to stay. They kicked Jews out of their businesses, their homes, confiscated them, and used the wealth of the rich to pay for the immigration of the poor. They used intense propaganda to sow hatred amongst the German population, and when the most radical of them took to beating or killing their Jewish neighbors in the streets, the police stood by, or helped. They even turned to Zionism, happy to ship off Jews to Palestine, so long as they weren't in Germany. But a funny thing happened. No one wanted them. Some Jews got stuck in a loop, pushed out of Germany into Hungary or Austria or Poland, and booted right back to start the cycle again. Some made it into neighboring countries, only to be subsequently conquered by Germany and find themselves under Nazi control again. The British, afraid of continuing Arab unrest at the growing Jewish population, shut down immigration to Palestine. And America? Well, with the economic hardships of the Great Depression, no one wanted more mouths to feed, more competitions for jobs. The Senate couldn't even get a bill passed to accept 20,000 Jewish children into the country. FDR did bring together 32 countries to discuss the Jewish problem at the Evian Conference, where they all sat around and talked about how bad the situation was, made excuses for how no one could do anything about it, and went home. But the worst offenders, or perhaps the most painful, were the assimilated Jews of the West, who, desperate to protect their hard-won status, encouraged the refusal of their own Jewish brothers and sisters. They had no desire to help solve the Jewish problem. They didn't want more Jews being all Jewy all over the place and messing with their comfortable and secure place in civilized society, which, of course, helped not at all when the Nazis rounded them up for the camps all the same. In his masterwork, Nazi Germany and the Jews, author Saul Friedlander notes, "The flames that Hitler set alight and fanned burned as widely and intensely as they did, only because, throughout Europe and beyond, a dense underbrush of ideological and cultural elements was ready to catch fire. Without the arsonist, the fire would not have started. Without the underbrush, it would not have spread as far as it did and destroyed an entire world. History is doomed to repeat itself. In the 30s, it was Hitler. Today, it's Hamas, who lit the match on October 7th in hopes of burning the Jewish people to the ground, which in many cases, they literally did. But without the underbrush of the West's useful idiots, many of whom are those same assimilated Jews who will only dare be as Jewish as society will permit. These are history's ever-present, uncritically thinking masses whose excitement to hate Jews, or at least turn their backs on them, was apparently laying latent just beneath the surface. Without their willing help, this fire might have been contained long ago. Now look, I don't believe we're headed for another Holocaust. There are enough adults who do know history, who do support Jews, who do possess at least that much moral clarity, that a systematic genocide feels safely off the table. But the parallels between today and the 1930s should give us pause. This is where the road to hell starts, and we have got to get off it. What's bad for Jews anywhere is bad for Jews everywhere, whether you're a rabbi or you've never even met one. Bigotry doesn't care about class or career or reputation. It does not see individuals. It does not discern. When the mob comes, they do not stop to ask how observant you are or if you follow JVP on Instagram. And what is bad for Jews is bad for everyone, because blind, prejudicial hate only thrives when morality and critical thinking and humanity are absent. And that's a problem everyone should want to solve. This is the 22nd episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. My guest today is one of the great political speechwriters of the 21st century. Yeah, it felt crazy writing that too, but it's true. Her golden oratory has found expression in the mouths of iconic Democratic leaders like Al Gore, Hillary Clinton, and Netflix producers Barack and Michelle Obama. She also loves to attend silent meditation retreats, which I find fascinating for someone whose career is also essentially about not using her own voice out loud. A correlation, methinks. But most importantly, to me at least, she is the author of Here All Along, one of the definitive contemporary guides to what it means to be Jewish. This lady became a human yeshiva and did all the homework for you. You just get to be enlightened and inspired by her intelligent and approachable insights, which, Baruch Hashem, shine through in her own voice, which was obviously here all along. Please welcome the brilliant Sarah Hurwitz.
That is such a kind introduction. I really, thank you so much. And Jonah, I mean, thank you for using your voice to bring Judaism to people. Like, what an amazing thing that you're doing.
That's very kind of you
really
to say.
Thrilled to be in conversation with you.
As am I. Speaking of which, so many people kept saying your name to me. They're like, you don't know Sarah Hurwitz? Like, I feel like you shouldn't meet Sarah Hurwitz. I mean, now that I've interacted with you, you're so kind and humble and funny and Jewish. So I get it. Why do you think people were saying like, oh, Jonah, Sarah, yeah, that's a match.
I think they just know I'm like hugely enthusiastic about Judaism, that I'm just this big Jewy nerd and I just want to tell you about it. And I think that I think you share that.
That's
right.
Perfect.
I think that you're sharing this passion and this love and this enthusiasm in a way that's accessible. That's not like judgy or esoteric or academic, but just like, okay, this is a tradition with 4,000 years of wisdom about what it means to be human that we desperately need right now.
I love that. That's exactly what this show is trying to be. All those adjectives, yeah. Or not all those adjectives that you just said.
Right.
In true Torah style, which you speak a lot about in your book, let's bereshit this thing. We'll start at the beginning.
I've never heard it as a verb. I love
right.
it. Okay.
Thank you.
I'm going to use that.
Yeah, please take it. You speak about in the book that growing up, you were culturally Jewish,
right.
Even though that you weren't really even exposed to that much culture outside of a couple of holidays and Hebrew school.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any anchors to Jewish identity, or was it just sort of a surface sort of tangential connection?
You know, my parents, which I'm so grateful for, they really felt, while they were not particularly engaged or observant, they really wanted us to have a Jewish identity. So they sent us to Hebrew school, you know, which we didn't love. They dragged us to services twice a year at the holidays. You know, we did a kind a modified Seder with my bubby where it's like someone did the four questions and we ate bonzo ball soup.
Right.
There was some sense of Jewish identity, okay. Right? I feel lucky I didn't grow up with nothing.
Right.
But, you know, I did call myself a cultural Jew, but I knew nothing about Jewish culture. I had no connection to peoplehood or Israel. You know, it's I essentially meant like I feel Jewish in some way I can't define, and so I'll just call it cultural Jew.
Yeah, I like how you made that distinction because I think a lot of people use that term but have the same experience. They're like, I actually don't know Jewish culture. I'm not immersed in it at all.
Exactly.
Except for I just know that I'm Jewish.
Right, and it kind of diminishes the people who are actually cultural Jews who say, look, I'm not particularly religiously observant, but I'm passionate about peoplehood or Israel or history or Jewish thought or art or music or food. Like, that's a very rich Jewish identity.
Mm-hmm.
But my Jewish identity of like, oh, I'm kind of intellectually inclined and also anxious, like that, and like kind of funny. It's like, really? Because
right.
Plenty of non-Jews have those traits as well.
But there is something distinctly Jewish in there. So I'm not sure what the more appropriate term would be.
Right. We got to think on that.
Yeah, we'll
brainstorm. Like brainstorm afterwards.
Do you have any beloved childhood Jewish memories that stand out to you, really positive ones?
You know, we used to do a Hanukkah party with family friends. And
nice.
I think that sense of Jewish community, right, of like being with good friends, of food and comfort and warmth, like I feel that. And I do think, you know, doing Passover with my bubby, who is this amazing woman, as kind of, you know, as minimal as our Passover practice was, I still feel a lot of warmth around that.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah.
And you were bat mitzvahed.
I was.
I don't even need to ask the question. Say more.
I mean, there wasn't like a Torah portion per se,
okay.
And I played the flute with the son of the rabbi, who may or may not have been a rabbi, we're not sure. I asked my mom recently, I was like, was that guy who did my bat mitzvah, was he a rabbi? And she was like, oh, sweetie, of course. I'm a spiritual leader for sure. Like,
what? And wait, what do you mean you played the flute with his son? What was his son doing, and what did you play on the flute?
We played, I don't remember what, we played like a song together, and people read poetry. I probably did a few of the basic prayers. It was a very beautiful coming of age ceremony.
That sounds very unique.
It was
very personal.
It was a beautiful event. So I don't, you know, I have nothing bad to say about
That's
it.
So
I just
nice.
Wasn't, it just wasn't very traditionally Jewish.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No.
How are your flute skills these days?
Terrible. Haven't
Gone.
Played in decades.
So you have a quote from your book that I love. Mm-hmm. When it comes to Hebrew school and getting bar bat mitzvahed, we stop learning at 13, mm-hmm. which is really when you are just old enough to start learning.
Right.
Which is like, duh.
It's devastating.
It's totally right. And so backwards, what's the approach? Like what changes do we have to make to create educated, connected Jewish adults? Because we're certainly failing that right now.
Here's the problem. And there are so many reasons for this that are understandable and I have a lot of compassion for. But the average American Jew, which I think I was 10 years ago, has no idea that there is Jewish wisdom. But like growing up, I knew what Catholics said about abortion and contraception. I knew what various politicians said about the death penalty, poverty, immigration. Did I know what Judaism said about those things? No. Did I even know Judaism had wisdom about those things? No. And you could say to me, well, how, come on, Sarah, really? That's how did you not know that? My only points of contact with Judaism were, you know, Hebrew school, which was the pre-age 13, so kid stuff, and these two kind of dull services, which I didn't understand, and Passover, which I vaguely understood, and Hanukkah, and that's the Judaism, right? The Judaism is four holidays. There's not.
Right, it's the rituals.
It's the rituals. It's the so it's like, why wouldn't you, eventually find your way to Buddhism or Burning Man or therapy or self-help? Like, Jews are smart, thoughtful people looking for wisdom about how to live their lives today, how to deal with the challenges they face, and at no point does the Judaism most of us grew up with show them that. We have millions of pages of wisdom on this stuff. And the problem is that like you kind of, by the time, when you turn 13, I think that's when you're really mature enough to start grappling with it.
Mm-hmm.
You can, not to be too fine a point about it, you can be exposed a little bit before that, but that's the point where we stop and we don't even know what we're missing. I think for me, that's the devastation and the heartbreak. When I finally discovered like, wait a second, this tradition has Jewish wisdom about how I treat other people. Like how do I help those in need? It's not just help the poor.
Right.
It's like tremendous wisdom about how precisely, how much, how do you do this? And I almost felt a little betrayed.
By whom?
I didn't even know. And it's what ultimately led to my second book. But I think Jews are smart. They're looking for deep, substantive wisdom. And until we can make our tradition really show our Jews what is in our tradition, I think they're going to keep going elsewhere or kind of minimally engaging in Judaism, but maximally engaging elsewhere.
Do you have a fix? Like an idea of what's missing? Is it a program? Is it more books like yours?
I hate to say this.
Fix everything wrong with Judaism.
I hate to say this, and it comes off so harsh, and I don't mean it this way, but like we each have to grow up, and I had to do it. Like I had to become an adult Jew, and it was hard. Right. And I think that the way you do that is you educate yourself. And that doesn't mean you don't have to read sophisticated esoteric texts. I don't think you need to learn Hebrew. I think what you do is you start reading books like mine, you know, Intro to Judaism books. Like my book was really designed for this exact
right. Well, thing. That's it's a big space. And yours is the only book that I'm aware of that sort of is layman's terms for all this stuff. Or, you know, the human yeshiva, you did all the work.
Right.
So that, exactly. That regular people can understand the Cliff's Notes.
That's the thing. People don't have 3,000 hours to learn.
No.
Right? So it's like, okay, no, 3,000 hours, forget that. But here, 10 hours. Give me 10 hours. And, my book is not just how to. It's not just like how to light the Shabbat candles. Like, you can Google that. It's really the why to.
Yeah.
You know, why does this matter? So it's kind of going deep that way. I think taking an Intro to Judaism class can help. I think once you know the basic contours and you have that kind of like net of basic Jewish ideas, then you can start to catch things in that net that are more interesting, that are deeper. You can start to pursue aspects of Jewish tradition that you're interested in. You know, maybe you're someone who likes to debate about ethical or legal issues. Great. You can do that. Maybe you love to host Shabbat. You can do that. Maybe you're into spirituality. You can do that. But to do any of that, you need the basics. So I think starting with the basics, and I think we as adults kind of have to take responsibility for doing that. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why we can't do this.
So you attended Harvard, earned 2 degrees, super lazy. So Harvard's home to many Jews, or at least traditionally has been.
Fewer. A lot fewer
now.
Day.
Yeah, which we'll speak about. My grandfather went to Harvard. A couple cousins went to Harvard.
Okay.
I've read that you said you never felt or saw any anti-Jewish anything when you were there. Were you aware of the sort of institutional past of being prejudiced towards Jews? Did you sense that at all?
You know, it's so interesting. I tell college students today, and this shocks them. I'm like, I could have walked through Harvard Yard, wrapped in an Israeli flag, yelling, I am a Zionist and I love Israel. And I asked them, do you know what would have happened to me? And they're like, oh, what? I'm like, nothing.
Right.
Nothing. People would have just thought it was sort of weird, but it wouldn't have. I never once felt any anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, anti-Semitism masquerading as anti-Zionism. I never felt that. And I was aware of the past. You know, the Ivy League has this kind of very ugly past with excluding Jews, but I felt none of that. And Harvard was, I think, 25% Jewish when I was there. Mm. I've never, not for one second in college or law school, did I feel any discomfort for being a Jew, and man, is it different today.
Boy, Harvard was objectively terrible last year. Mm-hmm. We know all that. And Jewish enrollment is now at a historic low.
Yep.
Are you still connected to the school at all? I mean, do you feel a sense of loss as an alum?
I do. I feel a real sense of frustration, of disdain. And I think there's something really off there. I'm beginning to worry that education has become more and more like indoctrination. You know, and just the lack of viewpoint diversity.
Yeah.
The fact that, you know, faculty have political stands and they're kind of seem to be just, you know, imposing them on students as opposed to, you know, I visited West Point. I spoke at West Point.
Oh,
and I was
cool.
Just blown away by the faculty there who said, we pride ourselves on the fact that none of our students knows our politics. And one of them said, if you argue X to me, I'm going to argue the opposite of X.
Mm-hmm.
If you argue the opposite of X, I'm going to argue X right back at you because I need to make you think. And I was like choking up. Aww. When he was saying this, because after visiting so many college campuses where that value set is gone. And by the way, that's a Jewish value set. You know, this is our whole idea of argument for the sake of heaven. It's that you're hearing these opposing viewpoints. You're sharpening each other's minds by mm-hmm. arguing. You are getting closer to something smart and truthful and wise. And I'm not sure that's happening anymore at Harvard, and that's sad.
You mentioned you went to West Point, and you've spent a lot of time on college campuses
yes.
in the last year. Was that something you sought out specifically to do?
Oh, it was funny. When I was starting to work on my second book, I wanted to get a better sense of what was happening on college campuses, so I reached out to Hillel. Absolutely wonderful. And they said, look, we'll plan a little tour for you. You can kind of meet students, see what's going on, and that tour will start October 10th, 2023. We were planning this in August of 2023.
Wow.
So October 7th happens, and I'm texting with them. I'm like, do you still want me to come? Like, what should I do? And we decided the tour would go on. And so it wasn't a response to October 7th. It was really planned beforehand, but it became a response to October 7th. And it was, I came straight from like 1997 to 2023
right.
and the shock that I felt. I mean, on so many, we're very distracted by these big encampments and protests, which are terrible, of course. But I am much more worried about the pervasive, systemic atmosphere on these campuses, like the air kids breathe.
Yeah.
In a lot of campuses, you know, Israel is in the same moral bucket as the KKK and the Nazis, right? So if I said to you, Jonah, look, I'm a Nazi, sure, but I'm a liberal Nazi. That's insane, right? Or, oh, I'm in the KKK, but I don't hate minorities. Like, that's monstrous. Like, come on, we're not going to have a conversation about that. And that's what I think a lot of students on campus hear when a Jewish student says, well, look, I'm a Zionist, I'm a liberal Zionist, I care about Palestinian rights. It's like, Israel is now so evil, so untouchable, that there's no point of contact you can have with it, just like there's no point of contact you can have with the KKK or Nazis. And once you're in that level of rationality, there's no conversation to be had. You know, so many Jewish students told me they tried to meet with their classmates who were harassing them and like have a conversation, and they would be told, no, 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 that would be normalizing Zionists. I just thought like the extremity Whoa. Of this, and it's so confusing for these poor college kids because their anti-Semitism education has been Holocaust education.
Right.
So they get to campus, they're like, well, there are no Nazis here, but I feel really unsafe. And so I'm going to gaslight myself and say, well, maybe it's anti-Zionism, not anti-Semitism. And I have to walk them through like, okay, if a classmate of yours, you know, I was like, can I walk through your campus with a t-shirt that says, I love Israel? And they're like, oh God, no. I'm like, okay, what if a black student came to you and said, you know, my campus is great for black students, but I can't wear my Black Lives Matter t-shirt, I'd get harassed. And the student's like, oh, that's racism, that's terrible. Great. You know, gay student says, my campus, great for queer students, but if I wear my pride t-shirt, I will be harassed. Like, it's not great. That's homophobia. That's,
right.
So I was like, so how come if you wear your Israel t-shirt and you get harassed, you don't think that's anti-Semitism? And they're like, no, 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 but the problem, it's not Jews, it's Israel. I'm like, okay, what if your Chinese American classmate wore a t-shirt that says, I love China? Even if your classmates knew what a terrible human rights violator China is, I'm guessing they would think, well, okay, I'm sure she doesn't love the Chinese government. She's probably just passionate about her heritage, or maybe she's studying Chinese history or language. I think your classmates would give her the benefit of the doubt.
Right.
And that is not something that happens for Jewish students. And it's Dara Horn, who's one of my best friends and an amazing Jewish author. She talks about the difference between Purim anti-Semitism, which is like, you're a Jew, you're bad, I'm going to kill you. There is nothing you can do to be good. You can't convert. You're bad, I'm killing you. Whereas there's another kind of anti-Semitism, which is like, you're a Jew, you're bad, but there is something you can do to be okay. You can give up whatever it is that I, the majority, think is disgusting about Judaism. And so back in the day, you know, if you were a Jew converted to Christianity, they wouldn't kill you. For some time, at least.
Yes, I have.
For a while,
if
maybe.
If you got lucky.
You know, you could convert. And today, I think I think about my parents' generation, the 50s, if you were a Jew and just get rid of your last name, your nose,
right.
Your Jewy gestures, right? Be less Jewy and then you're safe. Today it's, you know, get rid of your Zionism and yeah. then you're safe. And so you see these poor kids who are like, you know, they're like, you know, my rabbi growing up told me Israel was great. And then I got to campus and I learned there were genocidal, colonial Nazis. I saw the light. I had an epiphany. And then I took anti-Zionism and anti-colonialism into my heart and now I'm saved. And their classmates are like, now you're saved. You're a Jew who's seen the light. And it's like, guys, 2000, like really, you can't come up with any new material 2000 years. Like, I feel like we deserve better. Like, it's just the same garbage about Jewish depravity, conspiracy, and power.
It works.
Same garbage.
Broke, don't fix it.
That's the thing. Once the neural groove is worn into the Western world psyche, it's like, it's a canyon, right? And it's not that hard to shove someone into a canyon.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you feel like you had an impact while you were there, like on these kids? Do you feel like they took in what you were saying and were able to feel safer or at least more prepared?
You know, I do. I mean, the Jewish students I met at these Hillels, they are extraordinary. Like they, you know, they have been just told for so long, you know, your feelings don't matter. Shut up with your, you know, your Jewish privilege. You need to decenter your story. And so they've realized they can't just throw a tantrum and have everyone scamper around them and help them. They actually need to use their words. They need to marshal facts. They need to make arguments. So they have really learned to think, you know. And when you have to decenter yourself all the time, you spend a lot of time listening to other people's stories. And so now they have a very deep sense of the diversity around them, and they understand that. So I was very impressed by them. And I do think just to have someone tell them, this is anti-Semitism. It is not okay. Let me clearly articulate why this is so scary and upsetting for you. And just to really show compassion for them and just say, like, guys, this is not okay. I didn't go through this when I was in college. Like, I think that was helpful for some of them, at least.
When did your tour conclude?
Still going on.
Okay, so yeah. Have you seen a change since you started?
You know, I do think this year things are better.
Good.
You know, I think a lot of
it seems that way from the outside.
Yeah, I think a lot of campuses have started just shockingly enforcing their own rules,
right,
which they would enforce with regard to every other student group but Jews. So
right,
they started enforcing their rules. I mean, I think, but I do think that pervasive atmosphere is still there. I think it's maybe a little less in your face, but I don't, it's better, but it's still absolutely awful.
Did you go to schools all over the country, all different kind of places, sizes, everything?
Everything. And people would say to me, well, the real problem is the elite schools. I'm like, nope, went to plenty of non-elite schools. Oh, the real problem is the small schools. Nope, went to plenty of, there's no pattern.
What kind of advice would you give to parents of high school kids now who are trying to decide where to go?
Yeah, you really have to know your kid. Like, I think there are some kids who actually, they do just fine. Mm-hmm. Even in the worst schools, they find the Hillel, they find their community, they're tough, they're you know, if anything, it's kind of I don't want to say good experience, but they mature and grow through it. Other kids are just not built that way. And you got to just know, like, okay, how's your kid built? And if you know this is really going to get to your kid, find a school where they're not. And find a school with a really good, vibrant Hillel, like a really good, vibrant Jewish community. I think that is a big difference. You know, you're looking at two things, how anti-Semitic is the school and how solid is the Jewish community.
Right.
And you, between those two things, you can figure out what to do.
Good advice. Okay, so I want to talk now about, we've hit your childhood, we hit college, now we're on to your working life.
Right.
1998, you interned for Al Gore before he was famous for being a documentarian. Most important question of the interview, did you write the lockbox speech?
I did not.
Did somebody actually write that? That wasn't Al Gore?
I have no idea.
We have no idea.
I was just an intern. I wrote like video scripts and did research, so I can't take too much credit.
But what was it? What was that like? I mean, was that your first gig?
It was, you know, it was my first speechwriting gig.
I mean,
barely speechwriting. It was thrilling. I mean, I worked for these lovely guys who would like, you know, let me come for videotapings. They'd let me do research and they were so kind to me. And I, you know, just to see that the job of a speechwriter, like, you're at the center of everything, right? You're working directly with the principal. You're traveling. You're working with everyone in the White House. I remember thinking, like, what a thrilling job.
Cool.
It was very cool.
That's awesome.
Very cool.
Okay, so then we jump to 2008. Mm-hmm. You're Hillary's head campaign speechwriter.
Right?
I just want to know, it's funny. It's like in your bios, whatever line, it's always like, okay, 1998, she's an intern. 2008, I'm like, what'd she do for 10 years? What happened in between? So briefly, what did you do for the next decade?
So I did a junior job in Maryland state government as the assistant for a speechwriter. Then I was a speechwriter for a senator, both of which they were kind of failed jobs. I really just didn't know how to write speeches.
Mm.
I went to law school, which was, you know, turned out to be a life mistake, but I figured that out by about week three. I was like,
oh no,
this is not.
Did you see it through all 3 years?
I did. I saw
it
through and I was a lawyer for a couple of years, but I met a guy named Josh Gottheimer there, my third week of class, who's now a congressman from New Jersey, and he had been a speechwriter for President Clinton. So we started freelancing together and then Hillary.
How was she as a boss?
I didn't have a lot of direct contact with her because it was a campaign. She was
right,
often
she's
traveling,
all over the place.
But I mean, she is so brilliant and she is so deeply passionate. I mean, she feels these issues deeply. Like it drives me absolutely bananas when people portray her as fake or as someone who doesn't care or who's ambitious. It's like she spent her whole life doing this. Like her first jobs are working with children who are in really difficult conditions. Like she's the real deal.
Yeah.
And I it really frustrates me.
I understand.
Yeah.
Your speeches win Barack Obama the presidency. Do you ever feel that way? Like you're like, I did that to anything, for anyone. You're like,
No. No, because here's the thing. With people like the Obamas, like people are always like, oh, you put words in the Obama's mouth. I'm like, I'm sorry, have you met them? Like no one puts words in these people's mouth. Like they always knew what they wanted to say. They always had a sense. So a lot of it, it's channeling them. It's like it's much more of a partnership. So I never felt like, oh, that's my speech.
How was Barack as a boss?
Lovely. It's just he's such a gracious, warm, just a lovely guy.
He's not regarded as being particularly friendly towards Israel. Did that ever come up, or it wasn't really on your radar yet?
It's not really on my radar. And I would say, I think that's overstated.
Yeah.
I actually think if you look at his policy record, it's really not that different from Biden's or from anyone else's. Like it's really, you know, and again, I need to immerse myself more, but I think that's been kind of overstated. I think there's a vibe sense that people seem to have that I don't think is quite right. But I'll leave it for another day.
Okay.
But.
So then 2010, you become the voice of Michelle Obama, and you stick with her for the duration.
Yes.
How was that shift moving from, you know, the principal to the first lady?
People thought it was a very weird move. Because some people were like, why are you demoting yourself?
Right.
But the truth is, you know, I never felt quite at home in President Obama's voice. Mm. Right. And I didn't have the kind of long relationship with him that my friends who'd worked on the campaign did. And he was just talking about the economy. I mean, the economy was crashing. So every speech was like, the American Recovery Act has three parts. And I don't enjoy writing about that.
Yeah.
It was so much policy stuff. And I kept helping her out on the side. And I was like, oh, this is fun. Mm. Like her voice, I'm more at home in her voice. What she's talking about is more interesting. And so I made what a lot of people thought was a very poor career move. But it turned out to actually be a great career move because I would have always been a pretty mediocre speechwriter for him. But I was a really great speechwriter for her. And we got to just work on some amazing speeches together. And so I think so often when you do the thing that people think is going to make you less conventionally successful, it actually winds up making you more conventionally successful. Like kind of taking that weird path that just feels true to you.
I think that's such a great lesson that applies to any career path that you might be on. You got to listen to your gut and do what feels right and find – it's more important to, like, find a home than it is necessarily to do the right move.
The prestigious thing. Like, when you feel like you're swimming against the tide of your life, you know, like, you can do it. Like, you know, you're a strong swimmer, right? You're tough. You're disciplined. You can keep swimming upstream, but it's just so exhausting. And when you finally step out and just jump into a different stream, you're like, oh – how delightful, you know, like I can kind of go downstream. So
welcome to my different stream. You're on it.
I'm totally on it, right? It's pretty great.
Huh? Yeah, I'm having a good time. Here's a tougher question.
Okay.
How has it felt to see Michelle be so quiet since October 7th?
So here's the thing, and this is going to be counterintuitive. I'm really grateful to her.
Mm.
I am, because here's what's kind of driven me bananas is people are like, she has to weigh in. She has to say something. It's like, okay. And then if she went and said something, I guarantee you, everyone would say, it wasn't good enough. It wasn't what we wanted. And then there's a whole other population of people who would say, well, she has to say something about Gaza and the Palestinians. And so she'd say that. And then we would say, oh, no, but she.
Mm.
There is no clean win here. Like, we think there is not. And I really wish that every celebrity who doesn't know what they're talking about, who is not immersed in this issue, I wish they would shut up. You know, I would just counter the people who said, well, she cared. She was talking about the girls kidnapped by Boko Haram, right? That was when she was first lady and they were kidnapped from a school and global girls education was one of her core issues. And I would kind of gently ask those people, like, did you speak up about the Boko Haram girls? And they didn't, right? Like, she has a personal connection to those girls. Like, I have a personal connection to Israel. I'm not going to speak up about communities that I don't have a personal connection to. And that's not necessarily bad, right? So I think she made the right decision.
It's a very interesting viewpoint.
Yeah.
Let's get into Here All Along.
Okay.
Which is a fantastic book I've talked about several times on this podcast. Give us the quick log line. How would you describe that book in a sentence or two?
It's a book that really tries to convey the most transformative, radical, inspiring wisdom that we have about what it means to be human today, about how to be a good person and lead a worthy life and find deep meaning and spiritual connection. I found that a lot of Intro to Judaism classes are now using it as a textbook because it does cover the material, but it's less a kind of how-to nuts and bolts and more a real, like, why does this matter?
Yeah.
And why do we need this?
I'm a decently literate Jew. Yeah, I went to day school, day camp. I've been involved in the community, all these things. And I still found things that I didn't know that I was able to learn from the book.
I've actually had very traditionally observant folks who are quite learned say to me, this book was for me. And I'm like, it absolutely was not. Like, I mean, this book did not contemplate you at all as an audience. And they're like, no, but, you know, I don't agree with how you practice. I disagreed with many things in the book, but I saw your love for this. And you made me re-fall in love with this. And I saw 550 endnotes. So I know you've done your homework, and I know you love this tradition like I do. And I think there was a sense of they saw my respect and love for the tradition. And, you know, something was bridged there, which was really nice, actually.
Speaking of those 550 endnotes, like, yeah. How long did this research take you? It seems like you read every Jewish text by anyone ever.
That's what it felt like, for sure. It took, you know, I wrote the book in about 17 months, and it was like, it should have been 3 years minimum.
Yeah.
And so, but I was a new author. I had no idea. All I'd written was like a 2,000-word speech. I didn't know what it would take to write like a 90,000-word book. So I was working much harder than when I worked in the White House. Like, 70 hours a week, every week. I mean, it was a lot.
Here's another quote that I like a lot from your book. For many of us, and we've sort of talked about this, but I still really like it. For many of us, our understanding of Judaism is frozen in childhood, limited to what our seventh grade minds were capable of grasping. While Judaism offers plenty to engage children, much of its deepest, most transformative wisdom is really only accessible to adults. To me, that's sort of like the essence of what this book is about.
Look, you can say to kids, be kind to the poor, or like, you know, be nice to workers. They kind of get that. But once you're an adult, you can study a text which says, you know, if you have loaned someone money and you happen to see them coming down the street and you know they are still struggling and can't afford to repay you, you should literally walk the other way. There's a Jewish text that says this because you'll embarrass them, right? Just walk the other way. Don't run into them. And there's another Jewish text that says if you go into a store and you have no intention of buying anything, don't ask the shopkeeper for the price of an item, right? Don't be like, oh, how much is that? Even if you intend not to buy it because you're getting their hopes up unfairly, you're wasting their time. And like, you can try to explain these stories to kids, but it's like what you begin to understand as an adult is that, you know, the very like weedy, specific ethical nature of Judaism, where you're drilling down and down and down, it's cultivating this exquisite sensitivity to the needs and the dignity and the humanity of every single person before you. So it's not just like, help the poor. It's right. This very specific scenario about the guy, you loan money, la, la, la. You know, it's not just be kind to workers. It's this very specific scenario because Jewish law is training your mind to see very clearly this person before you. You know, it's like the eye doctor when they click the little machine and your vision gets crisper and crisper. And I will point out that it is totally countercultural because our defining ethic for so many spaces today is let's just divide people up into two categories, oppressor, oppressed, and we'll hate and love them accordingly. Mm. Right? We're going to take that vision machine and click it the other way till everything is so blurry that all you can see are these two main categories, and then we'll humanize or dehumanize accordingly. And Judaism says, oh, hell no.
Yeah.
You are going to just find each person in their like particular exquisite individuality and treat them accordingly. In Jewish law, there's always like the, here's the rule, but if the person has this need, or but if the person has this disability, but if the person has that, then we do that. It's always a but if, and each one is a click of that machine. Each one is getting you to see the person more finely. And like, how do you explain that to a 9-year-old?
I don't know. When the first two examples you gave, I was thinking in my head, I was like, you know, I have nephews and cousins who are 13, 11, 9. I'm like, I feel like the 9-year-old, the 11-year-old could have a lesson about when you go into the store, don't ask for the price because you don't want to get someone's hopes up.
Right. That could be,
that
you know
tracks,
what? You
know?
Could do it. I do think there is a lot. There actually is a lot of substance you could deliver to kids. But, you know, we have a structure where it's like you have a lot of adults who don't know there is Jewish substance to be delivered. Yeah. And they're like, I want my kid to have a bar mitzvah. And so just teach them to read Hebrew phonetically for that. And that takes up the hour and a half a week we have allotted for this endeavor of Jewish education. It's
right.
Like, well, that's going to be a problem.
We're missing the good stuff.
We're missing the good stuff.
Okay, so you basically just alluded to this other quote that I'm going to read back to you. You say, I don't need Judaism to teach me how to be a good person, but I've come to realize that I do need it if I ever want to become a great person, which, you know, is in line with that clicking of the machine getting finer and finer.
Yeah.
How's that going for you now? And, you know, what are you focused on evolving or improving in yourself at the moment?
You know, it's a constant process of just being reminded that I could be doing better. And not in a, here's the thing, people often interpret this as like, oh, I have to feel bad about myself or shame. And I'm like, no.
Not at all.
The Jewish conception of the human being is like, you actually have a pure soul and you make choices as to whether to honor that or not, whether to honor bad impulses in yourself or good. And when you honor the bad ones, okay, you screwed up, you make tshuva, you return to the good impulse, you apologize, you remedy it. There's no shame and bad feelings. Like if anything, I think this is a call for strong self-esteem, for a sense of like, I have this pure good thing inside of me and I can choose and I can, when I mess up, I can return. So I think, you know, for me, it's like studying Jewish ethical text, I'm always just realizing like, okay, I could do this better, you know, or like, okay, that's something to think about when this particular situation comes up. You know, there's a very basic text about, you know, paying a worker pretty immediately for the work they do. And that's just something that I always have in mind. Mm. You know, when someone does some work for me, whether it's, you know, a research assistant or whatever, I make sure to pay them right away. It's something I'm really thinking about because that person might be depending on this payment.
Yeah.
So small, but like right there, you know, from the generic treat workers well, which is meaningless, to the, okay, that means you pay them as quickly as you can because they really depend on that. You know, I think it's a constant process of just having these things in mind and kind of refining character. And it's hard. I screw it up all the time. Like, I've not, you know, it's more an aspiration that I think you slowly rise up to.
Part of the difficulty of imparting all of this wisdom is there's so much of it and so detailed. It's like, yeah. How do you even wrap your arms around?
Yes.
Where would you even start on a, I'm going to make a lesson plan of the most important little Jewish value totally. Things. It's like, you know, thousands and thousands of years and thousands of volumes of text. That's a challenge.
It's a challenge. I think you start where people are. It's like, okay, what are people struggling with? What do you think people need to do better? What would, you know, what's missing? And then, or what counterculture, you know, what is a kind of ill of our society?
Yeah.
And what does Judaism offer? You know, I think about like the loneliness and the isolation epidemic that we have today. Jewish tradition, you know, everything about chesed, which is loving kindness, this idea that like, you know, you help out others in a way that you're really physically present with them. You know, when someone is sick, you don't just send them flowers. You get your butt to their bedside.
Right.
You sit with them. When someone's in mourning, you don't send a card. You show up at the funeral. You show up at the shiva, and you are with them physically. You know, that proximity, that closeness where we've just, you know, we're all alone in our room on our phones.
Yeah.
Right? Like the Jewish wisdom about the criticality of showing up and being present, like that's something we need. You know, I can see, okay, hole of loneliness. Here's the wisdom that Judaism has to help us fill that hole. And I think that's where it starts. Like, what are we missing? Where are we struggling?
What you just said, I feel like also really applies to Shabbat.
Yes.
That element of showing up and coming out of our rooms and turning off our phones and all of that. We talk about Shabbat a lot on this show. You might love Shabbat more than anyone that's come on the show, and everybody loves Shabbat. You talk about it a ton in your book and your experience with it. And where are you with it now?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I when I was in the White House, I experimented with having a pretty rigorous Shabbat practice.
Right.
And I loved it. And it was really... It was interesting. And then I came to kind of realize like this probably isn't the best idea for someone who's single and doesn't have kids, right? It's like, it kind of was, you know, I was kind of struggling with a little bit.
It's just like a little isolating?
It was like a little isolating. And so I was like, okay, how can I kind of dial it back? And now for me, you know, Shabbat is like, I don't like to go out to restaurants or to things on Friday night where I'm paying money to do something. It just doesn't feel right to me, right? That's a weekday kind of thing. So I try to do something with friends that's like in a home, you know, that involves community and togetherness, ideally Shabbat dinner.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Saturdays, I try to just be present. I try to, you know, take it a little bit differently just to see it as a different day. And I think Jews often, like people who are thinking about Shabbat, they get so caught up in the like, what rules do I need to follow? Yeah. And what if I do it wrong? It's like, okay, the general principle is as different from the weekday world as possible.
Right.
Right. And like, I think the Shabbat laws are actually super helpful for that. I think they're really wise for that and like a great thing to follow, but you don't have to follow every single one of them. A number of friends who are part of a modern Orthodox community in DC and like they all live near the synagogue, they're in and out of each other's houses. Yeah. It's like this, I mean, it almost feels like a bygone era. It's like the 1980s, like the kids are running wild, everyone's just kind of relaxing and no one has anywhere to go.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's like no one's running off. No one's stressed. Everyone is just so deeply there. And you're all creating this space together.
Yeah.
So I see.
It's really special.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing.
Something that I really resonated with, just sort of a large idea that sort of pervades your whole work is that you're always looking to imbue life with meaning, which I do a lot too in different ways than you do. You know, for me, it's like, if I'm going to own any item, like I want it to have significance. Like if I'm going to have a lamp, I want it to be my grandma's lamp, you know?
I totally, totally get that. I have a lot of that myself.
So I'm like, it's like, it annoys the hell out of my wife. Like weekly shout out to Courtney. You know, everywhere we go on a trip, I'm like, oh, let's get this. And this will be our new kitchen thing. Cause then every time we use it, we're going to think about this amazing moment in time. She's like, that's ugly. I want the one from Williams-Sonoma.
This is my entire house is comprised of things from various trips and things with that were my grandmother's. That's exactly, I get that.
What are some ways, big and small right now, that you're allowing Judaism to infuse your day-to-day with meaning?
As part of some learning I'm doing, a class I'm doing, I've been going through the Siddur, our prayer book, and actually doing my own translations of the prayers.
Whoa.
But just because I've begun to realize, like, the translations really distract me. You know, the English translations are just distracting and I get caught up on like, I don't like this word. Is this what it really says? So it's been fascinating to see the various roots and all of the, you know, each Hebrew word has a root, like a three-letter root usually. And, you know, it often shares that root with other similar words or with other even different words and their connections between the words. So, you know, Hebrew is like this depth language. It has a lot of depth to it. Every word has much more depth than it appears to have. And so that has been a very cool project for me.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I love the way that you talk about prayer, yeah. Which I feel like is a really significant barrier for a lot of people when they're
I get it.
When they're not connected or they're new to Judaism or whatever. It's a very sort of impersonal, impenetrable kind of thing if they don't know the words, or yeah. they do, but they don't know what they're saying, and they're just kind of saying. Where are you with prayer now personally? Yeah. And, you know, what would you say briefly to someone who is feeling that struggle?
Scripted communal prayer in a shul, it's actually, I would argue, not the most important form of spiritual practice in Judaism. I would actually argue that belongs to study. Like, I actually think Jewish study is I hate to say more important, less important. That's not a very helpful way of thinking. But, like, Jewish study is a spiritual practice. It helps you, I think, you know, hear the divine voice more deeply. And I think I think that oftentimes people think their only option for spiritual connection is the scripted thing in the synagogue. And if they don't get that, well, game over.
Yeah.
Study can be a very powerful spiritual practice. When you are studying the words of our ancestors as they are trying to hear the divine voice, you know, back from Sinai through history, I find that incredibly moving. And there are so many Jews I know who, you know, what happens in a synagogue, they could take it or leave it.
Yeah.
But study, they are like in it, right? They feel this deep connection. So I think I would actually argue, like, if you're struggling with that, maybe step away and try study as a spiritual practice.
How and where? In a way that feels approachable and accessible.
Yeah, it's such a good question. I mean, there are so many great organizations like Hadar, which, you know, is a wonderful Jewish learning institution in New York City, and they run something called Project Zug, where they actually match you up with a partner, a chavruta, and you study a text together, and they match you up with someone at your level. So
oh,
you can do
cool.
that. Or, like, you know what? Call your friend and be like, hey, the Torah, don't know much about it. Haven't really, you know, let's do, you know, the Parsha of the week, which is like the portion every week we read a portion of the Torah till we get to the end,
mm-hmm.
and then we start over. We
right.
do this once a year. And so, you know what? You can Google online, okay, what's this week's Parsha? Okay, print out the English. And then Rabbi Jonathan Sacks has amazing Parsha essays where he kind of explains the Parsha. He reflects on it. He's a beautiful, you know, rabbi of blessed memory. Print a couple of those essays. Print Shai Held's Torah Parsha book, which he has beautiful, you know, sort of a lesson. You know, he has beautiful commentaries on these Parsha. Read the Parsha, which will probably be a little confusing or
right.
off-putting or disturbing.
Right.
Read these essays, which will help you get insight, and then talk about it.
First of all, I love that suggestion.
Yeah.
I feel like you're identifying sort of a hole in, you know, institutional Jewish learning where it feels like it's Hebrew school or it's a yeshiva.
Yeah.
And it's like really tough. We're missing everybody in the middle who needs a much more accessible access point
yeah.
where, you know, I think a lot of people, what they like about the synagogue is, I mean, honestly, it's like they don't have to think. There's a rabbi who's going to tell
right.
them what to do and how to sit and where to stand. And that's, there's a comfort in that. And you also, you know, they're your spiritual leader and you want to
yeah.
be led. And I feel like if there was, we're missing that sort of dynamic of let me lead you on this journey of Jewish study and depth.
That's the thing. And look, I don't mean to in any way diminish or put down time in a synagogue. Like, that communal experience
oh, no, of course
is
not.
So beautiful.
And I'm sure
and
a lot of synagogues and anybody who works in one is like, well, we have these programs at our synagogue. I'm sorry. I know you do.
They totally.
You're trying so hard.
They totally.
Like,
they do, right?
Yeah.
But, like, people just don't come. I don't think people, I mean, so many Jews just don't know there's really wisdom there. So they don't even think about it. I mean, it is a hole that we have. And there are reasons why we've sort of evolved this way to kind of have, you know, the scripted communal thing in the synagogue, that's the Judaism. It's like, well, because that's sort of the Christianity. Like, I think it's sort of, we've sort of evolved to be like, oh, well, that's what they do, so we'll do it too. But
interesting.
Study is such a central, vital, deep spiritual part of Judaism. And I just, it breaks my heart. You know, until I discovered this, I kind of thought like, gosh, I guess I just don't really connect. I don't really, and when I found study, I thought, oh, no, I do.
Something you talk about a lot in the book and give great examples for is how to sort of infuse meaning into some of these stale, rote
right.
traditions, which really hit me. Because for me, like a lot of my Judaism, and I say this with love, is like just about being with family and sort of doing the things that we've been doing.
Right.
And having our own family traditions, they're not necessarily the ones from thousands of years, but all of that, just the tradition and the being
right.
together is meaningful. But the things themselves don't, I'm definitely not accessing the full depth of their meaning.
Totally.
And what sticks out to me is like when you spoke about Passover and ways to bring meaning into that in a fresh way, What are some of your favorite refreshes that you've discovered?
Oh, I love this. You know, I've been thinking a lot about how to bring meaning to the prayers, right? And like there's one, I was thinking a lot about the Hoshki Venu prayer, which is this, it's a beautiful prayer. It's like, you know, we ask God to lay over us a canopy of peace. That's what the translation says. And it's like, okay, yeah, asking for peace. It's like, I don't know, it's pretty, but it never really spoke that deeply to me.
Right.
And then I looked at the Hebrew and it actually says sukkah of peace. The word they use for canopy that's translated as canopy is sukkah. A sukkah is an open air structure. Like it's really not a very sturdy structure. Like the idea that you are going to find peace in this fragile structure that is open to the wind and the storms and the rain, like it doesn't say build me a stone castle of peace.
Right.
Build me an underground bunker with a prepper cabin of peace. Right. It's like go into this fragile shelter that could be, you know, that I could just blow down with my own breath. And that's where you're going to try to find peace. And I think about like what a profound thing that we're asking for. What we're saying is like it's a moment where we acknowledge like, wow, we are really vulnerable as human beings. We're really, there's so many things blowing through our lives. We're scared and we're vulnerable. And in that space, what we're asking for is to find peace there. I thought like, wow, that is a much more relevant prayer than I thought.
Yeah.
So oftentimes it's like, you know, trying to figure out like, what was the original intention of this practice, of this thing? Like, why were they doing this? Why did they care? And now, okay, how can this matter to us today still?
At least for me, like thinking about Jewish study, it's, from the outside, it always looks like homework, you know? It looks like it's going to be serious. It looks like it's going to be boring. It looks like it's going to be, we're going to be talking about like what type of wool I'm supposed to use on this
Your
Tuesday.
Your ox, Gore's, Shlomo's ox. It's
right?
Like, right, exactly.
So I think that's, you know, a large barrier is that. And it's hard to trust that there's going to be something worthwhile on the other side of that.
That's the thing. And I think there are so many organizations like Hadar, like Svara, which is this amazing queer yeshiva, that are just, they're actually doing the stuff that's relevant, right? They're taking the topic that we care about and bringing Jewish sources and wisdom to it. So I think there's so much of that out there, but it's, you know, it's not always easy to find.
Yeah. What was the hardest part for you about writing Here All Along?
My God, all of it. I mean, the research was so hard. Like just going through all these, I mean, like, we have a lot of really academically written texts that are just a slog to go through, and that was exhausting. And then it was just, like, anytime I wanted to write a sentence, there's always, like, 20 counterarguments to the sentence, right? Judaism resists being put into clear, simple sentences. And so that could kind of feel paralyzing sometimes, where it's like, you know, you there's just so many counterarguments that you have to anticipate.
I was thinking earlier in the interview, you were talking about like people aren't aware that Judaism has a wisdom about this certain thing. And I was thinking that part of it is like, it has 1,000 wisdoms about it. And you're like, well, I don't know which one is the thing. There's like 700 different arguments about it.
This is the problem. And it's, you know, when people are saying, well, what's the answer?
Right.
Here's the thing. It's pretty rare that Judaism's like, there's the one answer that every single person ever has agreed on through history, right?
Right.
Judaism often comes in dialectic. Which is like, you know, love the stranger, like care for the stranger. And also, you know, remember Amalek. Remember that your enemies have tried to kill you. So be wary, be careful. So it's like, be compassionate and open, but don't be naive and be wary. Both of those are the answer.
Right.
And you have to hold them both and you have to balance them both. And you're hopefully going to wind up somewhere between them. That people do not like that, right? That is a hard, that constant, it's like, you know, this old idea of like, you know, you have to keep two pieces of paper in your pocket. One that says the world was created for me. One that says I am dust and ashes. It's like, you know, total humility and self-esteem. You have to hold them both.
Do you know Rabbi Isaiah Rothstein?
Yeah.
He gave me those two sayings in Hebrew on like a little coin. It's on
no
each
way.
Side of the coin that I keep in my office.
I love that.
What's been some of the most meaningful responses you've received from your book?
I've gotten these really beautiful emails where people have said, like, I felt so distant from my tradition. I just felt like this wasn't for me. And I read your book and I realized like it is for me. Or like people who are like, I grew up with this terrible variant of Judaism that made me feel, you know, fill in every bad thing. And then I read your book and I realized like, oh wait, that's not true. Like that was a bad variant. Like that's not all of Judaism. I've also just been really moved by the people who are super engaged, who are super in it, who are like, no, but still there was something in your book for me too, because I hadn't expected that. And that meant a lot.
Yeah. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah, I hope.
Have you ever considered, or would you ever consider, you know, educating or being a rabbi or something on that line?
I am planning to be a rabbi, actually.
Hey, so, yeah, mazel tov.
I'm in the process of applying to a program now. And
oh, my
we'll
gosh.
See. Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing.
Thank you. It's, you know, the self-taught thing is fine and it's just barely gotten me through two books. And now I'm like, all right, I really need some good teachers and people to really walk me through the depths. So that's, yeah.
That's, I'm excited.
Thank you.
Okay, so we finally have arrived. You're writing a new book.
I'm writing a new book.
Tell us about it.
This book was actually me stepping back and wondering, you know, I fell so in love with Judaism and was so busy writing this book and sharing it. I finally, during the pandemic, sat back and was like, why didn't I see all of this in the Judaism I grew up with? Like, that's so weird, right? It's here. It's mm-hmm. amazing. And also, like, what was the deal with my Jewish identity for most of my life, which was like, you know, I'm a Jew, but I'm just a cultural Jew. And again, I didn't mean I knew anything about Jewish culture or Israel or peoplehood. Like, it was not a substantive cultural identity, which is beautiful. It had no content, right? It was like, I'm anxious and funny.
Right.
Or like, oh, social justice is my Judaism, which again, I knew nothing about what Judaism says about social justice. There are people who do, and that's a beautiful identity. Or like, I remember the Holocaust, which like, what a bummer of an identity, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's just, I was like, you know, I realized I'd spent my whole life like thinking that was a really empowering identity. Like, look at me, a modern Jew, just being a Jew I want to be. And I thought that it was empowering and freely chosen. And I then sat down and studied Jewish history. And I was like, oh, this is not a freely chosen identity. Like, this identity is really the heartbreaking logical outcome of 2,000 years of anti-Semitism and 200 years of Jews in a very understandable attempt to be safe and to fit in, erasing and giving up parts of their tradition. And once I realized that, I was like, this identity is so humiliating. Mm. Like, I want nothing. I felt like what a humiliating identity, the way that I was just going around telling everyone, oh, I'm not that Jewish. I'm not. Like, if you think of anyone you know from any kind of minority background or in any minority group, if they went around dismissing, degrading their identity the way that I did as a Jew and so many others do, you would be horrified.
Yeah.
Right? You'd be like, what are you doing? So I really wanted to share, you know, this journey through history. I wanted to kind of share with Jews that this identity, like where this comes from, what we've lost, you know, in our effort to survive in the modern world, right? Jews, we made ourselves, I think, more like Christians. We gave up a lot of our traditions in an effort to be safe and fit in. And thank God, because you and I are here today because of this. We're Jews because of this. I mean, what a heroic and noble thing our ancestors did is they tried to find a way to be Jewish that would allow them to survive. And like, yeah. Oh my God, the gratitude I feel for that and the heartbreak I feel at what I think they had to give up and what they had to leave behind. But now we have the privilege and the safety to reclaim that. So my book is trying to show Jews like, okay, what did we lose? How can we reclaim it? And how can we get rid of this very highly warped, infiltrated identity that has been really misshapen by both anti-Semitism, by Christian hegemony, and by a lot of really ugly forces?
That sounds really important. I'm really looking forward. It's actually, I in the monologue that precedes this episode, talk a little bit about what you just touched on. So it's actually perfect. Is there a title?
The title is As a Jew, and the subtitle is Reclaiming Our Story from Those Who Blame, Shame, and Try to Erase Us. It's actually available for pre-order on Amazon now.
When does it drop, for real?
September 9th.
Do your pre-order now. You set it and forget it. Is it done?
It's pretty much done. I mean, it's so different. You know, my first book was in no way controversial. You know, the thesis of my first book was like, guys, Judaism's amazing, right? No one was like, no, it isn't. Right? That was this is a pretty edgy book. You know, and I tried to be very nuanced and careful and compassionate, but this book has an opinion. This book is making an argument. And I think my last book was more just like, let me share the wonders of Jewish tradition. This is an argument about how Judaism has been shaped, how we've reacted to it. And it also contains two chapters on Israel, which is always a great thing to do for your career. I just feel like, why not? You know, let's just.
Good for you.
Seeing the lies people are spreading, seeing the ugliness, seeing just the unabashed anti-Semitism. I was like, oh no, I'm not. I think it was a cop-out in my first book that I didn't talk about Israel. Although I do think actually it was the right thing to do because I think it allowed people to actually focus on the rest of Judaism, but there was no way.
You can't talk about contemporary Jewish identity right now without talking about Israel.
Absolutely. I also think in my first book, I did not talk enough about Jewish peoplehood, and that's something I really regret. And so this book, I really lean into that. There is sort of this idea that Judaism is a religion. It's not.
Right.
We
talked about that a lot on here. That's like, to me, that's pretty much the number one misunderstanding.
And my, you know, Michal Bitton, who's this wonderful spiritual leader and scholar, you know, she talks about the difference between the of like ideology, which is like we believe in the same religion, hence mm-hmm. we're connected, and the ethic of family, which is like we might believe in totally different things, but if we're family, I stuck with you.
Right.
And, you know, Judaism, like we are a peoplehood, we're a tribe, we're a family, and it, you know, I think it's easy to lose sight of that when you think of it as a religion that you either believe in or don't believe in. Yep. Like that is not what we are.
It's a lot easier for detractors to pick apart things about Jews if they're not a people.
Mm-hmm.
If they're just, you know,
exactly.
a group of white people who believe something.
Exactly. I mean, like, why should a religion have a country?
Right.
Like, the levels of stupidity of that, it boggles the mind.
I'm inclined to give those people somewhat of a pass mm-hmm. because I don't think it's stupidity. I think it's lack of education. I think there's plenty of Jews who don't think of themselves as a people, as I think that's probably who your book is for.
Right.
And so it's hard to expect, the 99.08% of the world that isn't Jewish to know that if the point two don't even know.
I agree. And it's not, I don't mean to call people who think that's stupid.
No,
the idea itself is quite stupid, right? Like there's not truth to it, but you're right. Like, did I know that 10 years ago?
I didn't.
I thought it was Judaism and religion, Christianity. And mm-hmm. We think that, and that's, our ancestors had to do that to be safe. Right, they had to do that to become citizens in Europe. They had to say, "Oh, we're not Jews. God forbid." I'm a Frenchman of the Jewish persuasion. I'm a Frenchman of the Mosaic persuasion, and they did that so they could be safe. They didn't have the luxury of claiming their Jewish identity the way you and I do, and like because of them and their sacrifice, we have that luxury. And so, I mean, what a gift we have to be able to go back and reclaim all those things they had to give up.
Something I for sure think people don't really realize is that the religion was not even separate at all from the personhood until that big European migration.
The modern
era. It
was
just Jews are Jews.
Yeah, before the 1800s, it's like you weren't a Frenchman or a German. You were just a Jew.
Right.
Like you weren't like a person practicing Judaism.
Right.
You ate Jewishly. You woke up Jewishly. You treated your. I mean, it was your nation, your culture, your language, everything. It was just so 24/7. And when you make that into a religion, it's something very different.
Yeah. Okay, so now we're going to end off on something fun.
Okay.
A little lightning round. So I'm just going to throw a bunch at
really
you.
I'm really bad at these because I...
Great. Can't wait to see this.
It's amazing. Go for it.
I bet you're great. Okay. Favorite Jewish food?
I like matzo ball soup.
Can't miss. Delicious.
Yeah.
All right, you're doing great so far.
Thank you.
Favorite Jewish holiday?
Shavuot. I like the study. Yeah, I like all my studies.
There.
Yeah, I love the excitement about Jewish text. Right,
I've never done a Shavuot study.
You know, I've done some of the all-night stuff, often online, not in person, but I think it's pretty cool.
I gotta get more into Shavuot.
I need to do like the actual all-night in-person thing.
You should like convene it.
I should. I know that would be cool actually.
Yeah.
Right.
You'd be a great convener for some of these things.
In the future.
Favorite Jewish book.
Ooh.
You can name a favorite Jewish book.
Yeah, this is not most favorite, but I think Rabbi Jonathan Sacks' book, Letter in the Scroll, is just magnificent.
Okay.
It's really one of the best Jewish books.
Click that Amazon link. Favorite old-timey rabbi?
Oh, okay. Okay. I mean, Heschel. I want to go with Heschel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not
Abraham
so
Joshua
old-timey.
Heschel. He's not so old-timey. I mean, you want like old-timey?
I'm talking old-timey.
You know, I got to say, I don't know. A lot of Maimonides doesn't speak to me, but I appreciate his incredible mind. I appreciate the radicalness of what he was doing. Like I go with the Rambam. Okay.
What's a favorite or most used Hebrew Yiddish word in your daily life?
Oh, I think mishpacha, family. I like that one.
Favorite Jewish tradition you didn't know about before researching for your book?
Oh, that's interesting that I didn't know about. I mean, honestly, Shavuot.
Yeah, there you go.
didn't know that holiday existed.
Yep.
How embarrassing.
Not embarrassing. I'd say that's probably most American Jews.
I also say Jewish study. Mm. Didn't know about that.
Do you know the game Do, Dump, or Marry?
No.
You have to, I'm going to name three people, and you have to say who you would do, who you would dump, and who you would marry.
Okay, if they're celebrities, I probably won't know who they are.
Do, Dump, or Marry. But Al Gore, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama.
I mean, I can't think of them this way. I mean,
one of them you're going to do, one of them you're going to dump, and one of them you're going to marry.
My choices are Hillary Clinton, Al Gore, and Barack Obama. I cannot answer this question.
You can't do it?
I can't do it.
All right, fine. Favorite Jewish nonprofits?
Ooh, there's so many good ones.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Safaria, big fan.
Yep.
My God, what they have done is unbelievable.
That's like an online collection of all the texts.
I'll just say Safaria, but many others okay. that I also love.
Sarah, thank you so much.
Such
this
a
was
pleasure.
So enjoyable.
Thank you for having me.
I'm
this
glad we
great.
Finally got together. Everybody Seriously? Was right. You're awesome.
You are awesome.
Thank you. Enormous thank you to the amazing Sarah Hurwitz for meeting me here in New York, where neither of us live, just to record this. Again, her book, As a Jew, comes out September 9th, but you can pre-order it now. If you haven't yet subscribed to the podcast on audio and on YouTube, please do so. Those numbers are crucial if I'm ever going to monetize this thing. Speaking of which, I'm looking for episode sponsors. If you're interested, head over to jonahplatt.com/podcast for more info. Love you guys. See y'all right back here for the next meaningful episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. Big ups to everyone who makes this show possible every week. My executive producer, Matthew Jones, story producer, Sean Liviashvili, and editor, Mike O'Brien of Rainbow Creative. Consulting producer, Bethany Mandel, research associate, Samantha Greenwald, my amazing executive assistant, Josie Rothschild, social media manager, Yuval Yosha, and graphic designer extraordinaire, Noah Bell. Most of all, thanks to you, dear listeners, who even stuck around to listen to all these credits. Man, I freaking love you guys.